Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. I have SMA Type 2, and I am a columnist and forums director for SMANewsToday.com. Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. And today we have also with me fellow SMA News Today contributor, Michael Morale. You, of course, know Michael from his YouTube videos and from this podcast. So, Michael, great to have you today.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Absolutely. And we have a very special guest with us today. So we have with us a medical professional who is actually one of my former longtime doctors, Dr. Edward Smith from Hillsborough, North Carolina. He was my neurologist for well over a decade. And I've come to terms that he left me, you know, like, I mean, I've forgiven him somewhat, but he's now doing a private practice. And so we'll talk about that. But Dr. Smith, thank you so much for coming on today.
Great to be here, Kevin. Thank you for inviting me. And I was trying to remember while you were talking when we actually met. And was it actually over a decade ago?
It was over a decade because I think, like, if I'm not mistaken, 2011 was the first year. Which we'll tell a conference story from that year at the end of the episode, because that has to be out there. But no, because I remember, like, I know it was that conference in Orlando in 2011, and we had already met at that point. But no, yeah, it was around that time. So yeah, it was definitely over a decade. I was in high school, so yeah, we go way back here.
Well, how come I'm getting gray and you're not?
I don't know. I just turned 30. I don't know. It'll happen soon enough.
You don't dye your beard, do you?
Nah. Okay. I mean, I really don't like do any kind of like maintenance there. I probably should, but yeah.
Well, and we'll get into it. You know, I guess I'm sorry I left you, Kevin. I didn't mean to leave you, but I did leave you with a very good doctor who's actually younger, smarter, and funnier than I am. So that wasn't a bad trade-off, right?
No, I have my upcoming clinic appointment and no, I know we're in good hands. I just had to mess with me there, but yeah.
So give her a chance.
I will. Oh no, I will. Right. Oh, for awesome. Sure. But yeah. Great. Well, Dr. Smith, to get started, can you tell us just a little bit about your career and how you got involved working with the SMA community?
Sure. I'll go back to after medical school. I'll go before that. I was a late bloomer in terms of medical school. I started medical school in my late 20s, and that's a whole other story, but. I'm from Mississippi. So I went to medical school at the University of Mississippi and then did a pediatrics residency there, and decided during that residency that I wanted to go into neurology and specifically pediatric neurology, and came up to North Carolina and interviewed at Duke and UNC. And I'm a UNC alum. So I didn't think there was anywhere in the world I was going to ever go to Duke for anything. But I did, and I'm glad I did. It was a great decision at the time. And so I started at Duke in 2004 as a neurology resident, pediatric neurology resident. And then after 3 years of that, did what's called a neuromuscular medicine fellowship. So neuromuscular medicine is a subspecialty in neurology that, as the name implies, you diagnose and treat neuromuscular conditions, so peripheral nerve and muscle disease. So spinal muscular atrophy is under that umbrella, as are muscular dystrophies. And so not so much brain and spinal cord or central nervous yeah. system conditions. Although when I started at Duke, I was doing all of that. But over time was able to get more and more focused on neuromuscular clinics. And then I guess, you know, one thing I hope that I left, I parted from Duke this past summer at the end of June. One of the things that I did in my life that I feel happy about is starting the pediatric neuromuscular program. And I know you're not a kid anymore, Kevin, but you remember this transition. We had a model like a lot of places, academic medical centers that combined pediatric and adult care in an MDA clinic or multidisciplinary neuromuscular clinic. And for a number of reasons, I wanted to split off and have a pediatric version of that and separate from the adult clinic. And I did that on really good terms. I mean, we've all collaborated over the years, and a lot of my adult patients My adult pain, including you, followed me over to the kids clinic. So, and I think that was for continuity of care, right? I mean, we you know, you had a pulmonologist who we all know very well for years, and a physical therapist and other people who had been on your care team. And this was just an attempt, and I think it was successful, an attempt to really create a multidisciplinary clinic so that a patient with SMA, for instance, could come in and spend half a day with us on a Friday, either the morning or the afternoon, 4 hours-ish, and see everybody, meaning the pulmonologist, do pulmonary function testing, see me for better or for worse, see our physical, not just see our physical and occupational therapist, but you know, you can attest it, spend a good amount of time with them. So these are what therapists who know something about SMA, and social worker, dietitian, not so important for SMA, but we have cardiologists in that clinic. And so, so to wrap that all into 4 hours, in one location, you know, with a ramp and a hallway and no everything on one level, I thought was a much, it's burdensome enough with everything SMA patients have to deal with. You don't want the care to be any more of a burden than it has to be. And that was one of the big drivers behind doing that. So anyway, I finished my fellowship in 2007 and was started as a faculty member back then. So years before I met you. And then gradually just kind of built that program in parallel with that. Right around fellowship time, or finishing up fellowship, I did my first clinical trial, and that was in SMA. It was called the Carnival 1 trial, and that was looking at carnitine plus valproic acid or Depakote in type 1 SMA patients. And so I cut my teeth on that trial and didn't look back. I mean, it's subsequent to that, you know, every year I'd start taking on, raising my hand saying, yeah, we'll be a site for this or that trial. And in SMA, we've been involved in numerous trials. I won't go into them all, but we were involved in the Nusinersen program. We were involved in the Zolgensma program. You know, we are, although after I left, but I was going to be involved in the Biohaven program, and we could talk more about all those if you wish later, but so that kind of gets us up to June of 2023, and I made a very difficult decision back in the fall prior to that to part ways with Duke, mainly for a number of reasons, but one of the big reasons was I found it just really unnecessarily difficult to run clinical trials. It was very slow, very expensive, very inefficient. And there are a whole host of reasons for that. Some of it's just trying to do something like that at a big institution. So that was one reason. There were multiple others, but anyway, that was a really difficult decision. And I was fortunate to find another doctor who was coming out of fellowship at the University of Rochester, trained by a wonderful group up there and good SMA group, who was looking to move to the area and did not run away when I said, "You sure you can come down? You're just not going to be working with me. You're going to be working instead of me. And here are the keys to the shop, you know, and bye." So she was good enough to accept it and the position and is going to do a great job with the program. I know she is, and I'm still on very close to that program and the people who run it, and we talk on a weekly basis, trying to help with the transition. I think one of the hardest things, Kevin, about leaving was that so many patients and families in this area, there's so many unknowns. You know, there are things that are known. You kind of know something about natural history and without a treatment or treatments, here's what to expect. But even with these treatments, Nusinersen or others, you know, you're still an individual patient, and you know what the data show for a larger group, but you know, where am I going to be in 5 years or 10 years? And those are pretty much unknowns, and so many other things that are unknown. Newly diagnosed families, so many unknowns. And I felt bad about leaving because there was one known. I mean, it was, you know, every 6 months or so, you're going to come in Duke and see me for better or for worse, you know, a doctor who knew something or knows something about SMA, a doctor who knows my child or you, you know, the patient. You don't have to go through everything again and get them up to speed. And so that was maybe something to hold on to that was a little bit firm and hopefully reassuring in some way, somebody who would advocate for you if you needed a camp form sign or just anything or just talk. So that was hard. I felt like I was pulling the rug out from under my patients and families. But the flip side of that is that you know, I found a very good caller replacement. She's going to be more than a replacement. So our clinic program will continue to thrive. It will thrive probably way better than it did under me. And so will the clinical research. So Duke Children's will continue to have a very strong pediatric neuromuscular program, where they also see many adult SMA patients, and be involved in clinical research and involved with Cure SMA very tightly and very actively. And so I'm happy about that. So I think it's, in the long run, it's all for the best. And I'm happy to tell you later a little bit more about what I'm doing, the specifics, but that's my, I guess, in a giant nutshell, my career and how I got to where I am now. And it's been a wonderful ride. There've been ups and downs. Just like for you and everybody else in the SMA community, with lots of up talking about these treatments, and then they not panning out. But think about where we were prior to 2016, and where we are now. You know, it's unbelievable to me. Of course, a family that has a recently or newly diagnosed child, they don't have that perspective, and that child's now being born into a world where type 1 SMA, if you treat it early enough, it's very possible that baby may even have normal motor type 1 as it may even have normal motor development if you can begin or offer a treatment pre-symptomatically. So very, very different, as you know, very different world now in a very good way for SMA. But there's work to do.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And well, on that note, Michael, I want to hand it over to you to talk more about like your experiences with Spinraza and ask questions there.
Okay. Thanks, Kevin. Dr. Smith, first off, thank you for joining us today. These podcasts, I believe, and I know Kevin believes, offer the SMA community some great information, like, you know, on clinical trials, updates. We really try to focus on the positives, because before 2017, or actually before December of 2016, we didn't have anything to really clamp our teeth around and be positive about. So I've been on Spinraza for the past 7 years. It took me about 9 months to get started because everything was new. You know, the hospitals were still going through the procedures of being labeled as a dosing hospital or clinic. And I've been really happy with Spinraza. I actually went on Evrysdi for a little while when it became available, just to see what would happen. But I had some GI issues around that, and I couldn't get over those. So I went back to Spinraza. And while I'm still getting worse, I'm not getting as worse as fast, if that makes sense. So there are a lot of positives around the various treatments that we have. Again, I've got SMA type 3, been on Spinraza for the past 7 years, going on 8 years. When working with SMA patients, how do you help them in terms of pursuing other treatment options or different options?
Well, I mean, I've always looked at it like this. Again, it's an interesting new world to be able to talk about treatment options outside of supportive care, right? And SMA, which is also extremely important. I don't generally lean or push one over the other. I don't think that of the three big ones that we have, I don't I don't see a major difference among them in terms of efficacy. Now, you just mentioned your experience, and that's where it's important is when we're sitting across from each other in clinic and you say, you know what, we made this switch and here's what I've noticed and it's not good, you know. But I have tried to make options available and give my honest opinion, which I kind of just told you, at least on the efficacy side, and let the patient or family make the decision. That's with any treatment. It's always that's always the way I've approached. I mean, some people say, well, you're the doctor, you need to tell them what to do. And I was like, well, that I don't know. I don't even go through life like that. So I wouldn't want my doctor. I want my doctor to give me some choices and give an honest opinion on them. Does Zolgensma have a riskier side effect pro? Yeah, it does. But you know, that's early on, and I think then that wanes, and you know, for some families, maybe it would be advantageous to have a one dose, you know, drug versus or an oral drug or you know, every 4 months intrathecal. So it's an unusual spot to be in where now the dilemma is which drug do we choose? You know, right. I mean, right. who would have thought that, you know, back in 2012 or Kevin, when we met, you know, just a lot of vague talk about what's in the pipeline and coming and when is it coming? And so I think that's just the process, Michael, that you partner with the patient or family on and just try to be honest about it all. But I can't say I favor one of those three treatments over the other. I've had, you know, the story you told, I've heard stories in the other direction as well. Or yours was GI, but in terms of efficacy, you know, a patient who felt like they could do something now new on a different drug that they couldn't do when they were on the prior drug. So that's it. I mean, I think it's about giving information, giving an honest assessment of that, being humble and remembering that these are new drugs. Spinraza is still new in the world of drugs, right? And we have a lot to learn, especially in sort of long-term outcomes for more slow, long-term outcomes. You know, what, how are the patients who noticed the benefit in the first 3 years, you know, how are they doing long-term? And you brought up a really important concept, that you're not getting stronger, but you're getting weaker more slowly. So you feel like nusinersen, and this is the case with the other drugs as well, and many patients, that we're slowing they're able to slow the progression of the disease.
Right.
And so in that sense, they're not a cure, and nor do we think they could be, because all those motor neurons that you or Kevin have lost, these treatments don't bring those back.
Right.
Right. You're working with what you've got and trying to preserve those neurons, those motor neurons and their function. So, be great if we could get to the point where we had something that totally halted the progression of the disease.
Exactly. Yes.
But that's where, you know, that's where these other, if you want to call them add-on therapies, come in potentially. And a lot of buzz about the anti-myostatin approach, which we can talk about, and three programs are active there. There's another one that targets the neuromuscular junction where that motor nerve, the end of it, meets the muscle. And trying to help with getting the signal across to the muscle. So in that sense, we don't have a cure, but I think, you know, I hate to say it, but I think we approach that with newborn screening now, which doesn't help you or Kevin, but with newborn screening now, and being able to treat very early on, while the motor neuron population is still relatively robust and big and responsive to the treatment. So anyway, that's a long-winded answer to your short question, but that's
great.
That's my approach to sort of discussing discussing treatment options with right. folks. Same thing with clinical trials as well. It's like these are the ones that are out there, and here's what I think. I'm not going to generally raise my hand and sign up for a trial that I don't think has that I think has a potential to cause more harm than good, or you know,
right.
and I mean, honestly, those don't usually come across my desk either. So or they're not given FDA approval to move forward. So right. So that's I guess that's how I'd answer that, Michael.
Yeah, I think you know there was a lot of misconception, or maybe not a great understanding within the SMA community when Spinraza became available, because you know we were all hoping that, you know, hey, if I lost the ability to feed myself, I'm going to have the ability to do that. And I listened to an interview for a young man, I believe he lived in Arizona, and a television station was interviewing him. He was the first patient to take to start on Spinraza, and he said his doctor told him that in a year he would be up and ambulatory and able to walk. And I think a lot of us thought we would get stronger, but we've come to the realization that these type of treatments are not going to reverse damage that's already done, that it's going to slow or stop the progression. That's why me personally, I think more and more pharmaceutical companies will now start targeting muscle therapies, because we've already got Spinraza, we've already got Evrysdi, we've got Zolgensma for the, you know, younger population. So hopefully, I would say in the next couple of years, we're going to see something revolutionary. That's just my belief. That's my hopes and prayers, is that if I can gain the ability to feed myself again, you know, I know I'm not going to get up and walk. There has to be, reality has to play a part in this. But there is so much more hope on the horizon than there was, you know, 8 years ago. So I'm super excited.
Yeah, I hear you. So it's again, I mean, imagine being a family with a newborn now with SMA and being told it's got SMA without a treatment. This is what we think would happen with the treatment tomorrow or the next day. This is what we would expect to happen. That's where what that doctor said, which they never should have said, but what that doctor said, if they actually said it like that, is actually a realistic expectation, and right, and early on in newborn population. But I don't think, you know, I, the data that we had back when Spinraza was approved was in younger, you know, in younger patients, and certainly didn't have like much older type 2 or type 3 data. And I think that a lot of what I've done in the past 5, 6, 7 years in clinic is manage expectations. So, and just try to be realistic on these treatments. And to be fair, I mean, you know, everybody hopes for the best, and there's always going to be somebody who posts something about, look, I can bring my hand to my mouth, you know, and they probably can. I mean, I had a patient who said he could now take his shirt off and independently and couldn't do that. That's a big deal. That's a new skill, but I think that's generally the exception, Michael, not the rule. And so right. I always prefer to discuss it in terms of a spectrum, you know, and this is the least likely, this is the most likely, probably going to be somewhere in between, and continuing to get weaker, but at a slower pace is still a win. I mean, that's a good thing. Oh, it is,
definitely.
That's a good thing. And it doesn't mean that you're getting weaker, doesn't mean the drug isn't working. It's just, it gets tricky in clinic where Dr. Smith is sitting across from Mr. Schaefer here, and you know, and Kevin feels like, yeah, it helps me and in this way and that way. And you don't have a clone, thank God, of Kevin, who's untreated to compare to, right? That's what these placebo control trials, but those are limited numbers. So we for good reason, I think, you know, and we just assume that with this treatment, whether it's Spinraza or Evrysdi or whatever, that's your best chance in 2023 of slowing the progression to some degree, and at relatively little risk. I mean, Kevin, you've been getting, you must have had 25, 26 injections now. I don't know.
It's a little under, it's closer to 20, but yeah, but I've been on about the same time as I started November 2017. So yeah. It's around there, yeah, a little over 20.
And, you know, knock on wood, but I mean, I can't, I don't think of that drug or Evrysdi for that matter as a risky drug. I mean, I think the bigger risk with Spinraza is probably related to the procedure of giving it and not necessarily the drug itself. But so to have options that are relatively low risk and can do what these drugs can do is amazing. Just wish the cost wasn't what it is, but you know,
yeah,
that's our system.
Oh, that would be nice. But yeah, well, and on that note too, you know, we talked a little bit about upcoming therapies and the possibility of combined therapies as well. What can you tell us about that?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I think that your foundational therapy is super expensive, whichever one it is. And then you're going to ask payers like insurance to pay for another one or possibly two super expensive drugs on top of that. And so I get it. I mean, you're going to have to show, you know, FDA will approve the drugs, but who's going to pay for them, right? So you know, a payer like a Blue Cross Blue Shield or whoever, United Healthcare, you know, I would imagine they're going to want to see good data that adding this add-on therapy to nusinersen or Zolgensma or Evrysdi has a meaningful impact or a good likelihood of having a meaningful positive impact above and beyond that foundational treatment. And so that's, you know, that is what we're seeing in terms of the trials. Of course, you know, the three myostatin programs, Scholar Rock, Biohaven, and Roche are all looking at their drug on top of one of these other drugs, right? And so you can imagine too that now you're the ability to show a benefit, that bar is higher, than it would be in an untreated patient, right? In a non-Spinraza treated patient. So that makes it harder on their end, you know, to show a benefit. But I think that's the way you've got to do it. Mm-hmm. Unless you're trying to target a population of patients that just don't have access to Spinraza or Zolgen, you know, and say here, but you know, but I don't think that population really exists because these drugs are just probably similar price range. You know, Zolgensma, everybody knows how expensive that is, but over time, nusinersen is more expensive than Zolgensma. So you know, when you add it up, So I don't know, Kevin. It's been a question I've had for a long time because, of course, everybody talks about these combination therapies, but they're only meaningful if you can get them. You know, FDA can prove things all day long, but if nobody's going to pay for it, you know, no patients are going to get it. So and the companies aren't just going to give it for free. So it's on these companies to show the efficacy as an add-on therapy and provide produce convincing evidence for that.
No, that's great. And I mean, I know with the work you're doing now, like you have like insight there, but yeah, it's a topic being discussed at conferences and you know, I think it's a time will tell for sure. But yeah, those are all factors that come into play.
Yeah. And Michael, you brought up a really good point. So about muscle, you know, targeting muscle we've got three treatments that do a really good job helping out the motor neuron, right? So what else is in that neuromuscular pathway? Well, there's the nerve, there's the motor neuron, there's the muscle that motor neuron attaches to, And then there's that junction where it attaches, the neuromuscular junction. And we know the neuromuscular junction is not normal in SMA. And we know the muscle's not normal. But unlike some other conditions that I treat or treated while I was still a clinician, like muscular dystrophies, SMA muscle is pretty much intact, right? I mean, it's not normal, but it's not scarred and ripped apart and damaged. It's just not getting the juice it needs from the nerve. And you know, how many of those muscle fibers can respond to improve neuromuscular junction transmission. You know, I don't know, but something would be better than nothing. And if you can sort of begin to address the motor neuron health with one of those treatments we've been talking about, and then in addition to that, come at the other angle of is there something we can do that directly targets the muscle fibers that might make them larger or stronger? Maybe when we combine those two, there'll be a synergy and a synergistic effect and more benefit. And so that's, you know, that's the idea with these anti-myostatin approaches, and which have been used before in other, you know, I was in a trial was a principal investigator on a trial run by Pfizer in Duchenne muscular dystrophy patients, and it's a long trial, and they were unable to show a clear benefit from the anti-myostatin approach in Duchenne muscular dystrophy. What one reason for that might be, I don't know, but one reason for it might be that the muscle in that condition is so damaged that it really can't respond as well to a treatment like that as maybe SMA muscle could. And so we'll see. So we've got, I mentioned the Scholar Rock and Roche and Biohaven all looking at this with similar trials. And we'll see, but I'm hopeful that there'll be an additional benefit there so that, you know, a patient like you or like Michael, this would be potentially ideal for that situation where you might be able to gain some strength and who knows, even function or slow things down even more, you know. Uh-huh. Push. I think a lot of this is about moving patients who are destined to be type 1 over to type 2 or type 3, or type 2s over to type 3, or type 3s over uh-huh. type 4, and thinking of SMA more on a spectrum as opposed to these individual categories. So
right, exactly.
I'm not even sure what type 1, type 2, type mean anymore, right, uh-huh. With uh-huh. with these treatments. So it's more like I think we focus more now on copy number of SMN2 and what you might have been expected to have fit into, but aren't anymore. So good problem to have.
No, for sure. And I think that's the thing we've talked about a lot in recent years is how just the landscape of SMA is changing. And I think in addition to treatments, it's also just like other areas of healthcare. And Michael, I wanted to like hand over you to talk about, because I mean, like both of us do physical therapy, I do aqua, but that's another thing of like talking about holistic care and what that entails. So Michael, I just want to hear you about that and how that correlates with, you know, your treatment journey.
Yeah, you know, I started physical therapy not long after I started Spinraza. You know, we were always told not to do extensive physical therapy because we weren't on a treatment and we would eventually get weaker by doing all that. But once I started on it, it really changed me.
Oh, wait, Michael, you muted.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry.
No worries.
So when I started physical therapy, even my therapist, were not really sure what SMA was. They had to go out and actually learn about it. And I've been with a physical therapist now for 7 years, and I've been using the same one for the past 5 years. And I can tell that I'm a little bit better with regards to my core strength. So anyway, it's to me, physical therapy is something that I really believe in. I speak at various colleges around the country to therapists that are about to graduate with their DPTs. And I try to introduce them to the world of SMA because, you know, in their studies, they may get a 5-minute lecture about SMA. So anyway, what are your thoughts about patients taking taking physical therapy? I know some doctors say go for it. Some are a little bit more apprehensive about it.
Oh, I'm 150% in favor of it. I mean, I would never tell a family or a patient that doing physical therapy might worsen. So SMA is not a muscular dystrophy, for instance, and I recommend PT and muscular dystrophy, but you got to be a little more cautious. I mean, you're not going to damage your muscle by doing physical therapy. You're not going to injure motor neurons by doing physical therapy. You're only going to potentially help your range of motion and sort of, you know, how you compensate with movements. And so in my mind, there's absolutely no reason to tell anybody anything like that ever. So that you need to be careful with PT or OT. So on the contrary, PT is wonderful, but it's a burden in some ways. You got to get there. You got to get it paid. You got to get there. So if you can get there or have someone come to the house, great. I think so that as a foundation, but then having a physical, if you're fortunate and having a physical and or occupational therapist who will really help you with a home exercise plan or something that you can do on a daily basis on your, you know, it takes a motivated patient, but because, you know, once a week is better than nothing. But, these are things that are going to be more helpful if you can incorporate them on a daily basis.
Exactly.
The other thing is you guys, and Michael, I can't tell if you're in a wheelchair. So you guys know what these power chairs cost and how helpful they are, you know, but they're way too, just like everything, is way too expensive. And you also know how hard and long the path can be to get one right, Kevin, or get it one replaced.
Oh yes, we know all that too well.
But if I, one thing I always wished I could do was write a prescription for a swimming pool for every one of my patients.
Right,
and you could probably get a pool built for about what a therapy pool or something. Get a pool built for patients for about the cost of a wheelchair, I would think. I don't know that many. I have no idea, but it can't be much more. And aquatic therapy, and Kevin, I know you've done that for a long time. You could speak as an expert on that, but holy cow, man, getting rid of some of that gravity and getting the resistance of the water, being semi-upright, getting your body in a different position than it's normally in. And I just wish more folks had the ability to have something like that readily accessible and even at home, you know, where you could do it every day. So anyway, there's so many unmet needs but I used to say it jokingly, but it's no joke. I mean, I wish I could prescribe swimming pools, therapy pools for everybody because the other option is, if you even have an option, it's often you've got to drive to another town. And they may or may not have the right kind of lift or access to the pool, and it just becomes an ordeal, and you got enough to deal with. And so it falls by the side. Right. And doesn't get done. So Michael, I guess that's how I would explain that. And if y'all haven't had, I'm sure you have, but if you haven't had a SMA experience, PT or OT on your podcast, and I'm sure you have, I can recommend a few who could give more insight into that. But I would only see positive in PT and or OT. The only downside would be additional burden on accessing it and getting there, or feeling guilty, you know, if you aren't able to do it or miss a therapy session. And then also not all payers will pay for much in terms of therapy.
Exactly. And I think that's the frustrating thing, is that we need these therapies, you know, we need our treatments. And, you know, for a long time we were rejected for Spinraza whenever it came out because insurance companies needed more information. I know you had mentioned something about a swimming pool. When I was about a year and a half old, my parents knew, you know, I wasn't reaching the milestones. They took me to a neurologist to examine me for maybe 5 minutes. And he turned around and he looked at my mom and dad and said, yeah, just take him home and let him enjoy the rest of his life and go ahead and start planning his funeral because he's got a neuromuscular disease. Well, my mother was redheaded. And she, you know, when they say fiery redheads, you didn't really want to make her angry. So she found a daycare that had a swimming pool and she started teaching me how to swim. Yeah. And she, other parents saw what she was doing with me and they said, hey, can you teach our kids? Well, we ended up building a pool in our backyard when I was about 4.5, 5 years old. And I swam every day in the summer. I mean, it was a heated pool. My mother taught swimming out of our backyard because back then you could do that. And swimming really helped me with regards to range of motion and flexibility. After my spinal surgery, when I had my spine fused due to, you know, the curvature of the spine, I lost a lot of that flexibility and I quit swimming. But, you know, I've been with the Sync physical therapist now for going on 6 years. She's fantastic. Her name is Emily. And she genuinely cares about my physical health. She's able to work with me one-on-one for an hour. And, you know, the hard thing about physical therapy for SMA patients is the physical therapist basically has to do the exercise with you. You know, they can't say, here's a treadmill, start working. No, you can't do that. We can't stretch out on our own. And so I think a lot of physical therapists will start seeing more and more SMA patients in the future if they're not already seeing them. So
And I hope that
physical therapy. And one thing that I was going to tell you was when I started physical therapy, my legs were about a negative, a negative 48 degrees, which meant I was 48 degrees from being able to straighten my legs out at the knees. Yeah. I'm now at like a negative 15 or 16, maybe 17. So it's really helped. We do a lot of hip.
That's better. That's better than me.
Well, it's, I'm definitely better than a lot of SMA patients and other patients are probably better than me, but you know, physical therapy has just been a game changer for me. So I do greatly appreciate.
I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised. I mean, I wish there were a way to get more of it, you know, and I think that one of the things I think is if anything good came out of COVID, it forced us to use telemedicine as a tool. Mm-hmm. It didn't force us. I think we as a physician community have always thought there'd be great advantage to that, but our institutions wouldn't pay for it. You know, you gotta come to clinic and then COVID hit and all that changed. And now it's unfortunately starting to change back, but in terms of telemedicine. But I mentioned earlier the power of having a therapist who can prescribe a good home exercise plan. And I hear you, a lot of your therapy almost all would be passive. You know, someone moving a limb for you or, you know, so you need someone to help do that. But, you know, you could have guided tele PT a point, you know, where, or observed until they're ready to cut your caregiver loose and have them do this on a daily basis. And I think you already do probably a lot of that. Maybe, I don't know, daily stretching and someone helps you with that. But I'm sure there are ways to leverage PT, but remotely and OT for that matter, to help bring that benefit. And instead of once a week or twice a month or whatever, something you could do on a more regular basis or maybe a lighter version of it, but something you could do every day, and the PT could continue to follow you. Even do maybe like a monthly in-person check-in, but in between then it's remote so anyway I'm a huge fan and always have been of PT and OT, and I think that's because I've worked so closely with so many good PTs and OTs over the years. And that was PT and OT were there way before news and nursing, right? So and so that's what we had. And we knew there were multiple benefits, not just physical, but psychological even to PT and a global sort of therapeutic benefit. Yeah. And even your relationship, as you describe your therapist, I mean, it's a bond, it's a friendship. It is.
And, you know, yeah. I always tell people that my physical therapy is just as much mental therapy because yeah. I get out of the house. I get to see Emily. I get to work with her. I know a lot about her. She probably knows more about me than most of my immediate family, you know, and I think that's what really makes it fun and keeps the patient interested. So anyway, Kevin.
I know this has been a great discussion. I know we've covered a lot of different topics here and Dr. Smith, so just to wrap it up here, if you can just talk briefly a little about what you're doing now. And then also, if you don't mind telling our famous conference story from that first back in 2011, I think that would be the perfect way to end this episode, if you don't mind.
I can't. Yeah, you kept coming to see me even after that debacle.
It was hilarious.
I didn't think so. I'll finish up with that. But as I mentioned in the beginning of the podcast, I'm not employed at Duke anymore left after about close to 20 years when you include my training, which is my whole professional life. So that's what I did. I was a pediatric neuromuscular person at Duke. So that was a big deal. And for me, so that ended June 30th. And then starting July 1st, I guess not. So my new gig, my new title is medical director and principal investigator at RDRNC. So RDR stands for rare disease research. Let me just give a real short background on where it came from. So there is a pediatric neuromuscular specialist in Atlanta named Dr. Han Phan, PHAN. And I've known Han for a long time. And she was at Emory. So she did what I did at Duke, but did it at Emory University and Children's Healthcare of Atlanta for many years, and experienced some of the same frustrations that I was experiencing. And so it's not just, I think it's just a big sort of academic medical center bureaucracy issue. And so she ultimately left that position and started with just, I think, two studies out of her husband's urgent care clinic in Atlanta. She was kind of squatting on one end of the clinic and had a few exam rooms there and took a couple of the trials that Emory didn't want. And I think they were Duchenne trials. And that was just 5 years ago. It was 2017. So it's just, I guess, going on 6 years. So she started this clinical trials site, a freestanding or independent clinical trial site dedicated to running clinical trials in the pediatric rare disease field, and more specifically neurological rare disease, and even more specifically an emphasis on neuromuscular disorders, but all things neurological, but with an emphasis on neuromuscular. Okay. And so that has grown tremendously over the past couple of years because they do such a good job. They get their studies started so much faster, like within 2 months instead of a year, which, you know, for someone with SMA, for instance, a year is a long time. 2 months is less long. You know, you know this very well, Kevin, how we talk every 6 months about what's what's coming up or what's in the pipeline, and then wondering why is it taking so long? You know, So this allowed her to begin to address that, at least what she could on her end, and sort of speed things up. And also, I think, do a better job of just more efficiently running clinical trials than she could in her situation. Same thing with me. So she, Dr. Fannin, I think, heard that I was leaving Duke, contacted me, and asked me if I wanted to set up a similar site, but in North Carolina. And we talked a little bit, and I said, let's do it. So that's what we are. So there's the original site is RDR in Atlanta. And we have now established an RDR, Rare Disease Research NC, for North Carolina site, actually in Hillsboro, and are partnering with local people, entities for to help us run these trials to get, you know, things like DEXA scans or MRIs or muscle biopsies so that's all coming together, and we hope to be starting up a few trials here within the next month or two, and then quickly ramping up and taking on more trials next year. She started with two, and I think they're running about 35 trials now at RDR in Atlanta, with another 10 or so in startup. So you can see how rapidly they're just a lot of trials out there that are promising. I'm looking forward to being able to say yes to some of them and move forward with them. So that's what I'm doing now. And I'm so happy because, when I made the decision to leave Duke, this wasn't on my radar. She came to me after she heard it. I think I told my wife, I said, I want to start an oyster bar in Hillsboro where we live. And she quickly said, that was a terrible idea. I said, but all my neighbors think it's a great idea. They said they'd come to my oyster bar. And no, it's a bad idea. You think of something else. So anyway, that's where I am. That's what I'm doing. And it's here and right around the corner, actually, from my house, which is convenient. So to finish up, oh my gosh, Kevin. All right. So this was the Cure SMA conference in 2011 in Orlando, right? So 2011 would have been 12 years ago.
A little more, yeah. More like 13. Okay. There. Yeah. But yeah.
So my kids are now, my boys are now 12. 20 and 20.
My I'm terrible at math, but yeah.
20 and 22. So the younger one was 7 or 8, I guess. His name's Victor. And so, there's always this evening where at the Cure SMA conference where they have a wheelchair race where the researchers, the scientists, the physicians in my case, race in a manual wheelchair versus an SMA patient in a power chair. Okay. And I think probably for the however many years they had been doing that, the SMA patients have been undefeated pretty much. So in retrospect, it was my fault, but I didn't tell my 7-year-old not to turn on the gas, and he was out there to win, and we sure as hell won and beat a little type 2 patient, came across the finish line well before she did. And the way I remember, I don't remember anybody thinking it was funny, Kevin. I remember.
It's hilarious now, but yeah.
I remember hearing audible gasps. And I'm like, oh no, we didn't just do that. And we did. And I kid you not, I avoided that conference for 2 years after that because I felt so ashamed. And then other people said, well, they were close and they know you were trying and your son was trying and you won fair and square. Well, I guess that's one way to look at it, but I hope it doesn't start a trend. So anyway, I think I was gradually forgiven and have gradually forgiven myself. And it certainly wasn't my son's fault, but it's funny now. I agree with you, Kevin, but
it's one of the most, I've had plenty of conference stories over the years, but that's one I always go back to because it is a classic.
Well, maybe we can race at the next one and I'll whoop you.
Hey, we'll try. Yeah. Hey, I'll let you.
Because he's 20 now. He's not 7 and he's fast.
Oh, he can move. Oh, definitely.
Okay. Dr. Smith, have you seen these new power chairs?
Oh, my God.
I honestly, I don't think an able-bodied person in a manual chair would even come close to beating what these power chairs can do. I was at the mall, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago. And this little kid zoomed by me in a chair that was, and he was probably 7 years old, 8 years old. He was in a chair bigger, better, and faster than mine. And I'm like, wow, there's something wrong here. Because we never had a chair when we were kids that could go 8 miles an hour.
Yeah.
Now, 8 miles an hour, you think, oh, that's not too bad. That's fast. That's really fast. And I'm even uncomfortable. driving at 7 or 8 miles an hour in this chair. And I just got a new chair like Kevin. I've had it for 3 years, but I've had some really bad tailbone issues. But these chairs are amazing what they can do now.
Well, and something else that's always amazed me is I wouldn't have believed it unless I had seen it. But what would you think would be the youngest age at which a child could start independently running a power wheelchair?
It's actually funny that you asked me that. I met Kevin. I'd been working with him for a couple of months, but we first met in Dallas when the conference was here in the downtown Dallas area. And I remember seeing kids there that were probably, what, Kevin, 3 or 4 years old.
Oh, well, yeah. I've got to meet them.
Running power chairs.
Yeah.
Now, some of them were modified chairs, kind of like a governor on it, where they could only go so fast.
Yeah. And they're not going to hurt themselves or anybody. But.
Right, exactly. But I would say it would depend on the child.
Yeah, 100%. So what if I told you we have an SMA patient who years ago got behind a chair and did great and got her a chair and she kind of took off from there. She was 18 months old.
Yeah. That beat me.
I would not be surprised. I remember getting my first power chair. I was a freshman in high school, and I remember my father would take me up to the mall and I would spend all day just rolling around by myself because I never had that ability to do it. So imagine what these kids are going through. They're not going to have to wait to at least be mobile to where they're not stuck in a corner or dependent on somebody to push them around. So 18 months, while it sounds surprising, really isn't.
Well, I thought my PT was crazy, and that was the last time I thought she was, who I'm talking about, probably Kevin, the PT.
Oh, yeah.
But huge advocate for our patients and said, no, she can do it. Let's do it. And parents were okay with it. And like you said, it wasn't an 8 mile an hour chair, I don't think. Yeah. But
I will tell you that my old house, when I got my new chair, that house had some war wounds. I mean, there were some doors that really were not meant to be bifold doors, but after I hit them a few times, they were. But it definitely takes a lot of practice.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, indeed.
Well, this was fun.
This was great. Oh,
yeah. I hope it was helpful. Yeah.
Oh, huge. No, we really appreciate your perspective. And this is a little reunion for us. So I'll definitely come by the office sometime.
Yeah, and tell your folks hi.
Oh, will do. Absolutely.
And be good to Dr. Katz.
Oh, I will. I'm sure she'll be great.
Actually, give her a real hard time at first, and then Say, Dr. Smith's been bad mouthing you, and I want to give you a chance, but it's all been negative.
We'll start that way. See where it goes.
All right.
Well, awesome.
Michael, great to meet you.
Hey, Dr. Smith, thank you. It's definitely been a pleasure. Great. Definitely been a pleasure. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Kevin.
And also for our listeners out there, you can hear more stories and conversations like this by subscribing to the SMA News Today podcast. You can also connect with us directly on social media and our forums and follow smanewstoday.com for all the latest SMA news and perspectives. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. Thanks for joining us, and we will see you next time. Take care.
The information in our flash briefings and podcasts are provided for informational and educational purposes only. Be sure to tune in daily to SMA News Today for the latest news and perspectives regarding the disease. Discover more content that might be of interest to you at www.smanewstoday.com. And be sure to follow us on social media and join our SMA News Today forums, a trusted SMA community ready to welcome you anytime.